Book 3 of the Psalms, so we'll be going into the 4th book of the Psalms, won't we? The 89th Psalm is a Psalm of instruction. It's also prophetic, and it's credited to Ethan the Ezrahite. And I tried to do a little research on that and find out who he was, and he believed that he could have been in Solomon's time, alive at Solomon's time of rule. If so, then that makes this very prophetic. This it actually tells of God's covenant with David and the awesomeness of his power. And this psalm prophesies of God's firstborn son in his everlasting kingdom. And with those things in mind, we'll read this. And James already told you when we get to this chosen, just remember that this is one that is selected, handpicked. Okay? If I can get there, we'll start. I will sing of the mercies of the Lord forever. With my mouth will I make known your faithfulness to all generations. That's interesting, isn't it? In other words, I'm going to talk about it. I'm going to talk about your faithfulness. For I have said, mercy shall be built up forever. Your faithfulness you shall establish in the very heavens. Is God faithful? Is His faithfulness established? Of course it is. I have made a covenant with my chosen, the one that I selected. I have sworn to my servant David. Now remember, this is a song. Okay, so they're just singing this. And this is would be God actually doing the speaking. I've made a covenant with my chosen. I've sworn to my servant David. Your seed I will establish forever and build up your throne to all generations. Selah. We know that's a musical interlude, right? And the heavens will praise your wonders, O Lord, your faithfulness also in the assembly of the saints. For who in the heavens can be compared to the Lord? Do you know anybody? There is none, right? Who among the sons of the mighty can be likened to the Lord? No one. God is greatly to be feared in the assembly of the saints. That's interesting that he says that. You'd think that would be automatic, wouldn't you? But it isn't, is it? I have found that some of the heathen have much more respect for God than the church people. The church people just seems like they become numb and little to no respect, really. Especially for the what we call the house of God, for the building itself. Tear it up, destroy it, and incredible really when you think about it. But he tells us that God is greatly to be feared in the assembly of the saints and to be held in reverence by all those around him. O Lord God of hosts, who is mighty like you, O Lord? Now see how this goes from God talking back to the man talking. You see, and this is something peculiar about the Psalms. You'll see this happen in all of them. You know, it's changing who's actually doing the speaking. That's why you get a portion of prophecy just being spoken forth right in the middle of the song. It says, "O who is mighty like you, O Lord? Your faithfulness also surrounds you." And I don't know if this is what you were looking for, Tony, but we'll talk about it if you want to. You rule. Now, this translation says, you rule the raging of the sea. And it was pretty interesting in looking at this, trying to figure out exactly what the Hebrew said, but the definition is arrogance or majesty. And then in looking at this, in its context and all this, let's just keep reading. You rule the raging of the seas. When its waves rise, you steal them. Now, It appears to me like it's talking about the pride of the sea, so to speak. You know, the ocean is so powerful. And yet God's ruling over it. He set the boundaries, didn't He? He said you can come this far and you don't come any farther. And every once in a while you'll see it try to flex its muscles, right? But He said you rule the seas. And then this word, you steal them, this was real interesting to me. Because actually in the Hebrew it means to address in a loud tone. And I think about Jesus in Mark the 4th chapter, Matthew the 8th chapter, where He stills the storm. When He stands up and He says, "Peace, be still." I thought, you know, He probably didn't whisper that. Not according to this definition. But He probably knew this psalm. And He was God. Yet He was man and He could stand up and give the command, probably in a loud tone, "Peace, be still. You who have broken Rahab in pieces as one who is slain, you have scattered your enemies with your mighty arm." Now, does that mean anything to you? Broken Rahab in pieces? Well, I learned something here. Rahab is an epithet of Egypt. Did I pronounce that correctly? E-P-I-T-H-E-T.
Yes, you
do. And that's actually the name, and I found this interesting too. I was going to tell you what epithet was, and it just left me. I should have written it down. Let's look this up so we don't miss that. But while we're looking at that, let me give you the name Rahab means bluster, which means to speak loudly or arrogantly or in a bullying manner. And so when He says you have broken Rahab, He's actually referring to Egypt, not to the woman Rahab. And isn't that what He did? You found the word? You want to read the definition?
Mm-hmm. Does it sound like what you had, an adjective, noun, or phrase expressing some characteristic quality of the thing to which it's applied? Is that what you had?
I don't know if I know what that means.
Now,
say it loud enough.
Let me find it again. An adjective, noun, or phrase expressing some characteristic quality of the thing to which it is applied, or as attributive, expressing some quality ascribed to a thing.
Everybody understood that, right?
Here's a descriptive name or title.
Okay, a descriptive name or title.
Mm-hmm.
In other words,
it's for Egypt.
Right. In other words, when it says Rahab, it's actually referring to Egypt. And when you look at the definition I gave you and you think about it, why would He say Rahab? He's using the name. What did the name mean? He's talking about bluster, arrogance. Isn't that the way Egypt was? 10 times Moses goes and he says, you know, God says, "Let my people go." Now, who is God that you think I'm going to turn these people loose? You know, the arrogance. And then when Moses, as the plagues continued, then he would try to negotiate. And then Moses would call the plague off, and what would happen? He'd renege on what on his promise or whatever. You know, just the total arrogance not to obey God, but just obstinately disobeying God. So that's what it's talking about. I'll try to get you a better definition. I pulled that off my dictionary on the computer, and it gave a little better. You can understand the definition a little better. Okay. I thought I wrote it down, but I obviously didn't. He says, "You've broken Ahab in pieces," or "you've broken Egypt in pieces as one who is slain. You've scattered your enemies with your mighty arm. The heavens are yours. The earth also is yours." Now, I want to just, the world and all its fullness, you have founded them. Now, I want to stop here just a minute and clarify something. There's been a teaching for years that God has given man the title deed or whatever. That God gave the title deed to Adam, and then Adam, by disobeying God, turned over the title deed of the earth to the devil. But the Bible is so plain to state the earth is God's. God never released the title. God never gave it to man. I'll tell you what He did give man. He gave him an order. He gave him a mandate. And what Adam's mandate was to take care of that garden. He didn't say the earth. He placed him in the Garden of Eden, right? And he was to plow it. Okay? And to guard and protect it. He was to till the garden, to guard and protect the garden. The garden. And how we come up with some of this stuff, you know, is beyond me. But to say that God just turned the earth over to Adam, the Bible doesn't say that.
Amen.
Yes, He did give man dominion. But there's a world of difference between dominion and possession. The president has dominion in the United States, but he doesn't own it. Right? Okay. Now look at this. It says, "The heavens are yours. The earth also is yours. The world and all its fullness, you have founded them." Now why would he say earth and world? Because one refers to land and the other refers to the inhabitants. Okay? So not only is it the land, but also the inhabitants as well. He says, "The north and the south, you created them." Now, I know that there's something here. I just know it. Okay? And I can't explain it. But there's something about the north. There's something about the north-south poles that have a dramatic effect on the earth, just like your the needle of a compass. There's that magnetic pull or whatever, always to the north, no matter where you go. Now God designed all this. He said, "You created the north. You created the south. You did it. You made these poles act like they're acting." We're not talking about Santa Claus now either. He said, "Tabor and Hermon rejoice in your name." Now Tabor and Hermon, get it out, are two mountains in Palestine. So he's just saying these two mountains in Palestine, they rejoice in your name. You have a mighty arm. Now, obviously, he's talking somewhat metaphorically, I think, okay? But he's talking about the strength of God and how that even creation recognizes God's might, God's power, God's possession. He says, "You have a mighty arm. Strong is your hand and high is your right hand. Righteousness and justice are the basis of your throne." Now, this translation says foundation. I think that's fine. But actually, the very basis, the very root, the foundation is righteousness and justice. Mercy and truth go before your face. Now, actually, if you just count down on that and thought about it for a little while, I mean, the throne's where all the decisions come, the judgments made, and all these type things. And when you think about it, buddy, it, everything coming forth from there, it will be right. It will be just. But it will be done with truth. It will be done in mercy. Judgment in mercy. I want the mercy, don't you? He said, blessed are the people who know the joyful sound. They walk, O Lord, in the light of your face. Now, we've learned a little bit about that, I think, the last time. What does that mean? When you get His countenance lifted up on you, the light of His countenance, it's a shelter, it's a protection. It always brings a blessing with it, doesn't it? It does. They walk, O Lord, in the light of your countenance. In your name they rejoice all day long, and in your righteousness they are exalted. You are the glory of their strength, or the ornament of their strength. And in your favor our horn is exalted. Now, does everybody know what that means? You lift your horn up over your head, right? Actually, if I understand this correctly, it's talking about power. In your favor, because you favor us, then our power is exalted over the enemy. Now, this translation says, for our shield belongs to the Lord, and which is, there's nothing wrong with the translation, but it actually seems to be implying that our defense. You understand that a shield is a defensive piece of the armor? So then our defense belongs to the Lord. Now, let me tell you something. If God's not defending you, if the Lord's not keeping the city, is what the 127th Psalm says, then it doesn't matter how many watchmen you put on the wall or how big an army you have. The city's in trouble. So then he's our defense, isn't he? And then it says, and our king to the Holy One of Israel. Now, if I understand the translation correctly, it, or the script, manuscript correctly, it's God is Israel's king, I believe is what that saith. God is Israel's king. Our defense is you. And you're the one who rules over us. Then you spoke in a vision to your Holy One. Now, Holy One, I think I know how they got that. But actually, by definition, the word means kind or pious, such as a saint. And that's probably where they're putting in Holy One, okay? So you spoke to your saint, or your pious one, and said, I have given help to one who is mighty. I have exalted one chosen from the people. I have found my servant David with my holy oil. I have anointed him. Now, I wonder who he's talking about here. Could it possibly be Samuel?
Yeah.
With whom my hand shall be established. Now, that just shows you that David was an ambassador for the Lord. But even though he's a king, he's acting under authority. He's not the absolute authority. He's under the authority. And that was why David was so successful, because he constantly sought the Lord in how to go in and out in battle and all these things. David had a heart for the Lord. So consequently, we can say David was ruling Israel, but in reality, it was the Lord ruling Israel through David, because David did what the Lord wanted him to do. Now, that's theocracy. You understand? It's not dictatorship. And you have to understand the difference between dictatorship and theocracy. The dictator is the one who does what he wants. Theocracy is when the leader does what God wants. Democracy is when the people do what they want.
Mm-hmm.
You see the difference? And the only rule that God will put His stamp of approval on is going to be His, to where He's ruling it, not man, whether it's a single man or a group. God, that's not God's approval, you understand? His approval is where He speaks and men execute His orders. Okay? So He says, with whom my hand shall be established, also my arm shall strengthen him. Who's it talking about? David. The enemy shall not outwit him. Boy, they tried, didn't they? But were unsuccessful. Nor the son of wickedness afflict him. I will beat down his foes before his face and plague those who hate him. But my faithfulness and my mercy shall be with him. And in my name, his horn or his power shall be exalted. But now look at this. It sounds to me like all of a sudden we're getting beyond David the person into the seed of David being Jesus. And I will set his hand over the sea and his right hand over the rivers. He shall cry to me, you are my Father, my God, and the rock of my salvation. Now listen to this. And I will make him my firstborn. Can't be talking about David, can it? The highest of the kings of the earth. Now who could that be? The King of Kings, right? My mercy I will keep for him forever. And my covenant shall stand firm with him. We talk about the new covenant, right? Which was the covenant that God cut in Jesus. His seed also I will make to endure forever. And his throne is the days of heaven. I ask you, or is the seed of Jesus still enduring? Let me tell you something. They tried to wipe it out generation after generation, age after age, however you want to say it. But they've been unsuccessful. They tried to kill the seed. They couldn't kill him. When the time came, he gave up his life. And then they marveled that he was dead so quickly. That just tells you they didn't kill him. He died in his time, not in their time. Amazing. But it says his seed endures forever. Right here. What we see in this room right here is a testimony of that seed enduring forever. We're the seed of Jesus. You understand that? Which makes us the seed of David. God keeping his word or covenant to David. Now look at verse 30. It says, if his sons forsake my law and do not walk in my judgments, if they break my statutes and do not keep my commandments, then I will punish their transgression with the rod and their iniquity with stripes. Nevertheless, my loving kindness I will not utterly take from him, nor allow my faithfulness to fail. My covenant I will not break, nor alter the word that has gone out of my lips. Now let me tell you something about salvation. There's two schools of thought on salvation and as to whether or not you can lose your salvation and this type thing. But you read this. Just read this. You can't lose salvation. You can reject salvation. But you can't lose salvation. And then if you go to the extreme of eternally secure, you're eternally secure if you don't reject. Does that make sense? Now, you can reject Jesus and you can be eternally damned. If you ever reject Him, you know you can only be saved one time, people. You won't get born again twice. Because if you reject Him, then you're destined for hell, for the lake of fire. Let's get it straight, all right? You can get out of fellowship. But what did He say? He said, if they break my commandments and all this, He didn't say He was going to destroy them. He said, I'll punish them. Nevertheless, And I circled that. I liked it nevertheless. He said, my loving kindness is not going to depart from him, nor my faithfulness, and I'm not going to break my covenant with him, nor alter the word that has gone out of my lips. Once I have sworn by my holiness, I will not lie to David. His seed shall endure forever. Well, Jesus is still enduring. And his throne as the sun before me. It shall be established forever like the moon, even like the faithful witness in the sky. And then we have a musical interlude here. This is a long song, isn't it, Tony? But you have cast off and abhorred. Actually, if I understand it right, it would be better to say, but you have rejected and spurned or disdained. You have been furious with your anointed. You have renounced the covenant of your servant. You have profaned his crown by casting it to the ground. You have broken down all his hedges. You have brought his strongholds to ruin. Now, this sounds to me like the destruction of Israel, or Judah, actually. All who pass by the way plunder him. He is a reproach to his neighbors. You have exalted the right hand of his adversaries. You've made all his enemies rejoice. You have also turned back the edge of his sword and have not sustained him in the battle. You have made his glory cease, cast his throne down to the ground. The days of his youth you have shortened. You have covered him with shame. Then the musical interlude. Now see, here again, if this person's who we think it is that wrote this in the time period, that was before all this ever happened. So this would be prophetic, the destruction of Jerusalem and of Judah. And I believe this is what he's referring to, if I understand it correctly. He's talking about the destruction here. How the you understand Israel was taken into captivity into or Judah was taken into Babylonian captivity. Israel went into Assyrian captivity. But Judah's taken into Babylonian captivity, and Judah is actually the ones we're looking at as far as the lineage of David goes. And they couldn't withstand the enemy, could they? And the place was destroyed. So it appears that this is prophetic. A song being sung about what's going to happen before it happens. Well, God can do that because He just happens to know stuff. Verse 46. How long, Lord, will you hide yourself forever? Will your wrath burn like fire? Now, did God break His covenant with David as far as his seed goes? Now, Jesus will be on the throne forever. There was a temporary removal, but the royal family never stopped. You understand, it did not cease. And I will tell you this, it hasn't ceased even now. They can trace their lineage. Okay? Will your wrath burn like fire? Remember how short my time is. Have you ever talked to God about that? Lord, I'm not getting any younger. Do you know how old I am? Remember how short my time is. For what futility have you created all the children of men? In other words, is this useless? Have you created me for uselessness or for vanity? No. What man can live and not see death? You know anybody? No. Hebrews 9:27 says, "This is appointed unto men to what? Once to die, and after that, the judgment." Can he deliver his life from the power of the grave? Well, let's take a musical interlude here. No, he can't. Lord, where are your former loving kindnesses which you swore to David in your truth? What did God say would happen if they did break the covenant? He said, I will punish them, but I won't just do away with them for David's sake, the essence of it. Remember, Lord, the reproach of your servants, how I bear in my bosom the reproach of all the many peoples with which your enemies have reproached, O Lord, with which they have reproached the footsteps of your anointed. Blessed be the Lord forevermore, so be it, and so be it. pretty long song. And that concludes book 3 of the Psalms. So we now go into book 4, which is Psalm 90. And this is documented as a prayer of Moses, the man of God. And it's a recognition of the brevity of man's life on earth and the need for man to realize his truth. Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Now think about that. You've been our dwelling place. I think of the cloud, how they were always with the cloud, and the ark always with them. You think about that. They were being led to the cloud, the ark, symbolic of the presence of God there in the Holy of Holies, the tabernacle. He said, you've been our dwelling place. And that place was set up right in the center of how they camped. If you actually study the encampment, and we did this in the Pentateuch. Yeah, this is a good illustration of it right here, a good picture. You'll find that they camped by tribe surrounding this. This was that tabernacle was the very center of their attention. Do you see that? You've been our dwelling place. That's what Moses is saying here, Lord, you. Because they went all around, you understand, staying in these tents, mobile. You've been our dwelling place in all generations, before the mountains were brought forth. Or ever you had formed the earth, and here this is talking about, it's right interesting. It's a word that deals with the earth as the land, the firmness. But it also talks about partibly, where it's partitioned, the dividing. And I thought that was an interesting word, not that I pronounced it correctly. It says, before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you formed the earth and the world, and here again we're talking about inhabitants now, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. Now, if I understand this correctly, this is probably what Peter's talking about in 2 Peter. Let me just go to it. The third chapter. And let's look at verses 5 and 6, 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 5 and 6. Says, for this they willfully forget. Not that they just happen to forget, but willfully forget. That means you don't want to remember it. And a lot of people are willfully, in this nation, are willfully forgetting God. They're doing it on purpose. That by the word of God the heavens were of old, now look at this, and the earth standing out of water and in the water, by which the world that then existed perished, being flooded with water. But the heavens and the earth, which are now preserved by the same word, are reserved for fire unto the day of judgment, perdition of ungodly men. After the flood, the earth was divided. Did you know that? Now, I know some people take this and teach pre-Adamites. Now, let me tell you something, people. I don't know if anybody existed before Adam or not. And if they did, then God's withheld that information from me, all right? In the beginning, God. It came out of God. You understand, God existed before the beginning. Beginning, end, it's all in Him. You understand, eternity has no time. God's eternal. Beginning came out of Him. And the only record that I have was in the beginning God created, and then we give the account of His creation of earth. We get the account of Him forming the man, Adam. Actually, the Hebrew word is Adam. Out of the dust of the ground, and then taking the woman from the man. And that's the record that we have, you understand. And to ask me where Cain got his wife and all this other stuff, I don't know. You don't know. And anything beyond what the Scriptures plainly state, speculation anyway. So be cautious with it. Okay? I think that this is probably relating to how the earth in its condition at that particular time in Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heaven and earth, right? It says the earth was what? Void and without form, and darkness covered the face of the deep. And then if you follow the creation pattern, it appears that everything was covered with water, because what he did, first thing he did was bring forth the light, wasn't it? And then what did he do? He separated land. He put a firmament in the skies, we call it, okay? He separates, and then the waters were divided. The land was divided, you know, the part sea, part water, however you want to say it, and part land. God did this when he created. Now, I don't know why the earth was void and without form. You understand? So why would I spend years studying what's not there? So be cautious. Now, with all that, we'll move on. You turn man to destruction and say, return, O children of men, for 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it is past. Now, let me ask you a question. Does that say that one day is equivalent to 1,000 years? Does it? No, it doesn't. Now, here again, let's go over to 2 Peter, chapter 3, and verse 8. 2 Peter, chapter 3, verse 8. But, beloved, do not forget this one thing, that with the Lord one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. Does it say they're equivalent? Now, see, here again, to me, is where people can, you can back yourself in a corner trying to prove a time frame, okay? Now, if I understand this correctly, here's the message that's being conveyed, and this is what you look for. What is the message that's being conveyed? It's time is of no essence to God. That's the message. 1,000 years with God, a day, 1,000 years, it doesn't matter. With eternity, you don't measure eternity. You understand? So, it doesn't matter if it's 1,000 years or a day. What's the difference? Eternity is eternity. And so when he says here, 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it's past. But it doesn't say it's equivalent to. And that's the point I really want to make. Because don't back yourself in a corner, okay? Now, to reiterate that, he says, and like a watch in the night. So this, to me, affirms that he's not talking about an equivalent, but he's trying to bring forth a concept here that time's of no essence with the Lord. Now, I don't know what their watch was. I know in the military, our watch, normal watch, was 4 hours, and then on special occasion, we might have a 6-hour watch. So then, is 1,000 years equivalent to 4 hours or to 6 hours? See, that would be a contradictory statement, wouldn't it? To say 1,000 years is equivalent to one day, and then to say 1,000 years is equivalent to one watch. No, that's not what he's talking about. The contrast that he's making is eternity to the temporary, you understand? That's the contrast, all right? You carry them away like a flood, they're like a sleep. In the morning, they're like grass, which grows up. Now, what's sleep? They're like a sleep. They're like grass. In other words, You know, you go to sleep, but you don't sleep forever. If you do, they bury you. Rip Van Winkle was a fairy tale or a fable or whatever, you understand. Which was it?
A lie.
A lie, okay, that's even better.
That's folklore.
Yeah. Folklore. It's definitely a lie. In the morning they're like grass which grows up. In the morning it flourishes and grows up. In the evening it is cut down and withers. So he's still talking about the same thing, you understand. These things are temporary. Well, God, it means nothing. It's absolutely nothing. In other words, it appears to me that Moses is trying to get in perspective is the contrast between the temporary and the eternal, between God's perspective and man's perspective. Okay? It says, "For we've been consumed by your anger and by your wrath. We're terrified." Well, we know that they refused to obey God and go in and possess the land, and God's letting them die in the wilderness, right? The whole generation. He said, "For you set our iniquities before you." Now, this next, does yours say our secret sins? That's, it really doesn't say that in the Hebrew. Let me just read it like I believe that it says it. "You set our iniquities before you, and you conceal the light of your countenance." Now, we talked about that light of his countenance. What did it do? Boy, it shielded, it protected, it blessed, and all these things. It says, "No, you've set our iniquities before us, and you've withdrawn that protection and all this, and now we're suffering the consequences." "For all our days have passed away in your wrath. We finish our years with a sigh. The days of our lives are 70 years, and if a reason of strength, they're 80 years." Now, here people have taken this and tried to make this the lifespan of man. But Moses is referring to his generation. Okay? None of us are living over 70, 80 years old. The people, in other words, what Moses, if I understand this correctly, what Moses is saying to God, out of this generation, none of this generation is living over 70 to 80 years old. The ones that came out of Egypt over 20 years old. He said, "We're dying before we get 70, and those who are really strong may live to be 80. So don't let anybody hoodwink you into thinking that you're supposed to die by the time you get to be 70, 80 years old. That's not what he's saying. You know anybody over 80? You do. Are they supposed to be dead? No. And don't accept that. That's not what he's talking about, okay? He says, "Yet their boast is only labor and vanity. For it's soon cut off and we fly away." It doesn't. He said, it doesn't matter. We live to be 78, so we live to be old. What is it? We have nothing to brag about. We're just going to go like everybody else does. So I need to stop. All right, we'll stop and take our break here. And then we'll pick back up. What? With verse 11. Psalm 90.